Israel and co. to demonize the resistance. Why is the resistance front still thriving?
Because Israel is massacring people and people are appalled by that. And obviously different organizations for many years, U.S. imperialism in the Middle East is not new. So there's groups that have had many years to organize themselves, to prepare for these types of moments. And obviously the same thing goes in terms of Hamas. They've known that the Israeli government's not going to concede a modicum of justice to Palestinians without a need to be militarily prepared, and they have done that. And Israel continues with its barbarism, and the government in Yemen, takes actions in solidarity against that barbarism, and those are the dynamics.
All right, let's leave it there. Author and political activist Eve Engler joining us from Montreal, and thanks to human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi, speaking to us from Houston, Texas, and of course a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم. فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها أصحابك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. Israeli genocidal war continues for the 121st day. The death toll now tops 27,200, mostly women and children. Palestinian officials warn of a possible Israeli onslaught on the southern city of Rafah, which hosts more than 1 million displaced Palestinians. Also in the headlines, the U.S. and U.K. carry out a fresh act of aggression against Yemen, launching nearly 50 airstrikes in 6 Yemeni provinces.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
The Israeli genocidal war in the Gaza Strip continues to take a heavy toll on Palestinian civilians for the 121st day in a row. Health officials in Gaza announced that Israeli forces killed over 100 Palestinians during the past 24 hours. The regime continued its raids and bombardments on various parts of the Gaza Strip. The strikes were mainly focused on the southern city of Khan Yunis. Regime forces targeted homes as well as displaced persons' gatherings. There were also reports of several strikes in the vicinity of the hospitals in Gaza. Over 27,200 people have been killed in Gaza since October 7. Most of them are women and children. Palestinian officials have blasted the international community's failure to stop the Israeli onslaught, the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Gaza. Palestine's foreign ministry warned against a possible Israeli military operation in the city of Rafah in South Gaza. The ministry said an aggression on the city would either lead to the annihilation of about 1.5 million Palestinians or result in their displacement. The warning came in reaction to comments made by Israeli Military Affairs Minister Yoav Gallant. He had earlier said that the Israeli army would turn its focus on Rafah along the border with Egypt. The Hezbollah resistance movement has struck several Israeli military bases. This came after the regime targeted a number of areas in southern Lebanon with air raids and artillery fire. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh earlier joined us from Beirut and gave us some details.
Well, Hezbollah, of course, today would target significant bases, Kibbutz Ma'ar, in the Galilee region, there's an area where you have a lot of Israeli tanks, especially Merkava tanks. And over there, they, of course, a launching site for the Merkava tanks towards Lebanese towns and villages. Hezbollah also focused a lot of their attention and their resistance operations against the Shabaab Farms, the Lebanese occupied Shabaab Farms areas, especially Samaka, which was targeted twice. But they also declared in their statements that they retaliated for the targeting of residential and civilian areas in Blida, Ait Ashab, and Yarun by targeting two settlements that are even Menachem and Yarun. And so, therefore, Hezbollah tends to make that differentiation between targeting direct military sites and areas that are considered settlements for so-called civilians, but despite the fact that they are now a closed military zone, still Hezbollah tends to make that that differentiation with what they target. And finally, also, they have targeted a group of soldiers in the a hill called Cobra. And so basically, those are the most significant resistance operations for Hezbollah. The Israelis did, as you said, target Yarun, Ait Ashab, and the town of Blida, which led to the martyrdom of two Lebanese civilians.
The U.S. and Britain have launched a new round of joint airstrikes on Yemen. The strikes mark the third time that the U.S. and the U.K. have conducted a large joint operation against the Arab country. Yemeni officials say the U.S. and U.K. warplanes conducted at least 48 airstrikes in six Yemeni provinces. The Pentagon claimed the strikes hit 36 targets, including buried weapons storage facilities, missile systems, and launchers. The U.S. military added that the strikes targeted drone storage and operations sites, radars, and helicopters. Washington says the attacks are meant to prevent further Yemeni attacks on ships in the Red Sea. Yemen says it's only targeting Israeli-linked ships to push for an end to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. This as the previous strikes failed to stop attacks on Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea. Yemen has also launched attacks targeting American and British ships in response to the Western attacks. On Saturday, the U.S. said it struck 85 positions in Iraq and Syria, claiming they included rocket, missile, and drone depots. Iraq and Syria have both condemned the attacks as acts of aggression. We earlier discussed the attacks and their consequences in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Now it's time for the news review section, where we talk in depth on the day's top story. The U.S. says it has carried out airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. That's after Washington pledged to respond to a deadly drone strike on its troops in Jordan. Iraqi government says at least 16 people were killed in U.S. strikes in the country. Civilians were amongst those killed, and 36 more people were wounded in the bombings that targeted both civilian and security areas. U.S. Central Command claims the targets include rocket, missile, and drone depots. The U.S. president says the strikes will continue at times and places of Washington's choosing. However, Joe Biden says the U.S. does not see conflict in West Asia. Washington has confirmed the deaths of three of his forces in the drone strike that hit his military base last weekend. It marked the first time U.S. military personnel died in an attack since the start of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Now, strong reactions to the U.S. attacks are streaming in from regional countries, not least by Iraq and Syria themselves. Iraq condemned the strikes as a violation of its sovereignty. It warned that the attack will have disastrous consequences for the region. Iraq's foreign ministry says it has called in the U.S. charge d'affaires in Baghdad to deliver an official protest. Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces said the U.S. attacks is a violation of the country's sovereignty and a blatant disregard for international laws. Syria, meanwhile, said the aggression caused casualties among civilians and soldiers and inflicted heavy material damage on the eastern part of the country. It added that this is the same region where Syrian forces are battling the remnants of the Daesh Takfiri group, and this proves U.S. collusion with the terrorists. Iran says the strikes are another strategic mistake by the U.S. or threat only serves Israeli interests. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also condemned the strikes, saying Washington has poured oil on the fire in the region. Yemen's Ansarullah movement slammed the U.S. strikes as flagrant violation of sovereignty of Iraq and Syria. The movement said the U.S. aggression against those countries proved its firm support for Israel's crimes in Gaza. Russia says the U.S. is sowing chaos and destruction in the Middle East. It has also called for a Security Council meeting. Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Rick Sterling, investigative journalist from Walnut Creek, California, and also Daniel Shaw, professor of race, ethnicity, class, and gender from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. Now, Mr. Sterling, beginning with you, let's begin with your initial thoughts on the situation right now. The U.S. has finally responded by not stopping the genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza, but by attacking the countries which are trying to stop the almost 4 months of onslaught on the people of Gaza. So what could we expect in the coming days? What could we expect from the Iraqi and Syrian governments and also the resistance groups in those countries?
Well, I certainly hope that the United Nations Security Council takes up the issue as Russia has requested. It's absolutely necessary because we're on a slippery slope here. A friend of mine who lives 125 miles north of San Francisco is reporting that there are military jets constantly flying overhead all day long, training and in preparation for what we don't know. Meanwhile, at another military Air Force base just outside of the San Francisco area, activists are planning to try to blockade that on Tuesday morning, and they're drawing attention to the fact that weapons from the United States going to Israel to continue the slaughter are being shipped out of Travis Air Force Base. So the Syrian and Iraqi governments, of course, are completely within their rights to be demanding that that this stop the aggression from the United States. I note that it's just 8 or 9 days ago that there was talk of the United States withdrawing their bases from Syria and Iraq. That was very welcome news. And then Victoria Nuland got into the act some days later, saying that the U.S. would absolutely not be withdrawing from the bases. The crux of the matter is that the neocons running U.S. foreign policy do not want peace, and they are constantly promoting expansion and war.
That's right, Mr. Sterling. Mr. Shaw, can the U.S. afford another full-fledged war, which is, again, like Mr. Sterling said, against their own people's liking, and at a time where they could use the billions of dollars of funding to Israel, and not forgetting Ukraine as well, while the money we're talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars, could be used to remedy its own ailing economy or to be used for humanitarian causes, not killing women and children?
That is the sentiment across the United States, especially among young people. Joe Biden's popularity among youthful voters is at an all-time low. The people of this country continue to march for peace, to march against the genocide. And we've been asking now for a week, if we look at the picture of these three young U.S. soldiers slash mercenaries, really are used and manipulated as mercenaries. They're so youthful. They come from an oppressed background. They didn't deserve to die for empire. It's extremely sickening how many of our young people from black and brown and poor white backgrounds have to join the U.S. military just so they can try to get a scholarship or feed their families. It's akin to the conscription or the economic draft and the actual de jure draft that existed in the 1960s and 70s and the horrific war of aggression against the Vietnamese people. And as Rick Sterling has pointed out, the Syrians, the Iraqis, this is a united Middle East that is saying they want the U.S. occupiers and the Israeli genocidaires out of their countries. We're seeing a pan-Arab unity, a pan-Muslim, a pan-Middle East unity that perhaps we haven't seen in many years. Palestine continues to be a lightning rod for anti-Zionist and anti-imperialist sentiments across the region.
That's right. Mr. Sterling, Mr. Shaw, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
There you have it, Mr. Rick Sterling, investigative journalist from Walnut Creek, and also Mr. Daniel Shaw, professor of race, ethnicity, and class and gender. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of the News Review program. Thank you for being with us.
More U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. This time, the House of Representatives has proposed a bill which would provide $17.6 billion in new military assistance to Tel Aviv. Speaker Mike Johnson says the House will vote on the bill next week. The new legislation would include funds to help replenish Israel's missile systems, procure additional advanced weapons systems, and produce artillery and other munitions. Some of the funding would also be used to replenish U.S. arms provided to Israel for its genocidal war in Gaza. The House had previously approved $14.3 billion in military aid to Israel. Political commentator Scott Bennett joined us earlier for comments. He said the U.S. support for Israel means Washington is complicit in the genocide that Tel Aviv is committing against Palestinians.
This is a confirmation of the United States being on the side of genocide, the side of murdering human beings, in particular women and children, in this demonic rage, rampage of death and destruction and hideous evil that the Israelis are unleashing upon the people of Palestine. And the United States Congress is going to be complicit with that. The only way to really effectively begin to fight all of this is both kinetically and diplomatically, as well as economically. And I think the Houthis and the shutting down of the Red Sea is a very effective economic warfare model that they're fully capable of doing, and I admire their courage for doing it. The other way to handle this, of course, is for a united front from other nations such as Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, writing a joint letter with signatures from each president to the United States Congress, declaring that you, the United States Congress, are put on notice that any weapons that you provide to Israel in the form of economic sustenance and such, you will be liable for the bloodshed and the genocide.
Thousands of Israeli protesters have rallied in Tel Aviv and several other cities, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters demanded the release of Israeli captives held by Palestinian resistance groups. The premier has been under fire for prioritizing his political interest in Gaza over the lives of the captives. Riot police were deployed to disperse the protesters. Netanyahu has been in hot water as he is embroiled in a series of scandals. The Israeli premier is charged with fraud and the breach of trust in a number of cases. This has prompted protesters to take to the streets almost every weekend to call for his immediate resignation. People in Pakistan continue to hold pro-Palestine demos in solidarity with the besieged Gaza Strip. This as the Pakistani government has demanded the UN Security Council to fulfill its responsibility to protect the defenseless people in Gaza. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more.
Civil society organizations, human rights activists, and political workers have launched a Save Gaza campaign by holding street demonstrations in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. They called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the implementation of the International Court of Justice's recent ruling that the Israeli regime must avoid genocidal acts in Gaza.
All of us are extremely upset and saddened. We watch every day hundreds of children and men and women dying. And the worst thing which those Palestinians are facing is they don't have anything to eat. Every aid truck which tries to enter from the Rafah border, the guards at Rafah border demand for $10,000 from all those truck drivers.
The protesters also slammed the U.S. support for Israel and its complicity in the onslaught on Gaza. They called for all members of Organization of Islamic Cooperation to cut ties with Washington.
What we are expecting from the OIC is that they should go with all of their armies into the Palestine and protect our people. And that's the least we can do. What we want is, that's what we expect from them. And what we want is, we want all of the OIC members to combine their armies and go attack US. Why? Because U.S. is the one who has started all of this monopoly in the region.
Meanwhile, the government of Pakistan has also called on the United Nations Security Council to fulfill its responsibility and impose a ceasefire to protect the people of Gaza, expressing profound distress about the continual acts of oppression against the Palestinian people. Islamabad denounced the recent Israeli attacks on hospitals and called them war crimes.
Pakistan's unwavering support for the Palestinian cause is underscored by the sheer perspective of its people and the government, who jointly urged the international community and the United Nations to actively engage to ensure a ceasefire and provide protection for Palestinians from the ongoing atrocities of Israeli forces in Gaza. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness, from thee. I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Islamic revolution and economic progresses. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the main reasons for occurrence of the Islamic Revolution was the poor economic conditions and deep injustice prevailing in the Iranian society. Most of the oil revenues before the Islamic Revolution were dedicated to the royal family, its near ones, and exorbitant military expenses. Thus, agriculture and industry were in very poor conditions. The Islamic Revolution prioritized eradication of poverty and creation of welfare for all, especially the low-income strata. Of course, this was a hard task, as there were few, if any, economic infrastructures, and the government's income was mainly dependent on oil. Furthermore, domestic unrest and foreign pressures aggravated the circumstances and put hurdles on the course of eradication of poverty and implementation of economic projects. Approximately 1.5 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein imposed an all-out war on Iran upon the order of his Western masters, especially the United States. This war continued for 8 years, and a great bulk of the active manpower and facilities of the country were appropriated to the battlefronts and logistics of the war. In addition, the triumph of the Islamic Revolution dealt a very big blow to the U.S. and its illegitimate interest in Iran and the region. Hence, Washington imposed very harsh sanctions on Iran since the very beginning of the victory of the revolution. Nevertheless, the Islamic system and the brave Iranian nation didn't give in to the hard conditions and did their best in the way of construction of the country so that, according to the report of the International Monetary Fund in 2022, Iran became the 22nd economic power in the world with $1,596,000,000,000 GDP. Moreover, the World Bank announced Iran's economic growth at 4.1%. Totally, it seems that most of the Iranian economic indexes are improving. Now, in addition to the efforts for inflation control, the government has prioritized two main policies on the agenda. The first priority is serious support for domestic production, and the second one is to increase trade dealings with neighbors. However, there has been a great growth in the products of knowledge-based companies, and the number of such companies has almost doubled till 2 years ago. Besides, the volume of Iranian trade exchanges has increased manifold compared with the period before the revolution. The share of oil export has decreased, while the scale of petrochemicals and non-oil exports have increased significantly. Iran's share of exports and imports of non-oil goods increased over 11%, $112 billion, in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended in March 2023, compared with the year before. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made great breakthroughs in the fields of industry and mines compared with the pre-revolution era. Thousands of small and big factories have been engaged in making of industrial products, which have grown both in quality and quantity. The largest industrial firms in Iran have been active in making of petrochemicals and mineral products. Large petrochemical complexes in Iran enjoy nearly 95 million ton capacity, which will be doubled with launching of new ones. Last year, Iran exported $16 billion of petrochemicals, and the officials have put on the agenda to reduce dependence on oil exports. This policy can decrease the effect of the U.S. sanctions, which have been brutally and illegally imposed on Iran. The Islamic Republic has also made great progress in mineral industries. 7% of the global minerals, amounting to nearly $770 billion, has been discovered in Iran. The exports of these products were $12 billion in the last Iranian year. Considering the high value of Iranian mines, officials have made broad plans for exploitation of these mines. Iran ranks fifth in production of copper in the world, while its position in iron ore is 10th. Moreover, it is the 8th country in the field of cement production, 62 million tons per year, and ranks fifth in ceramics production. Yet, as a boastful and spectacular progress in Iran, one should mention dam construction. While the Pahlavi regime had built just 19 dams, and that with the help of foreign experts and engineers, today the figure has increased to 10 times. What is significant and a matter of pride is that all these dams have been designed, built, and put into use by native engineers. The Islamic Republic has reached a level in the know-how of dam construction that many Iranian engineers are designing and supervising dam construction in 16 countries.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. Millions of people in Iran and across the world are celebrating the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the revolution saw the overthrow of the US and Israeli-backed Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This week's show explores the factors that brought about the revolution, including Imam Khomeini's focus on drawing inspiration from Islam and the Sharia to center the new government's foreign policy around support for Palestine and opposition to the Zionist entity. First, we look at the background to the events that led to the victory of the revolution.
On February 1, 1979, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini landed in Tehran to mark the end of 2,500 years of dynastic rule and the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. But it was the culmination of many decades of struggle by Imam Khomeini and his followers. Ruhollah was only 2 years old when his father was killed by wealthy local clans over his activism against their unjust landlord practices. And perhaps it was that spirit of activism and justice that ran through the veins of the young Ruhollah. He was raised by his mother and her relatives, and was soon enrolled in Islamic studies in his town of birth, Khomein. In his early 20s, he studied in the Islamic seminary in Iraq before moving to Qom, following in the footsteps of his teacher, Ayatollah Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi. He quickly showed his aptitude over the decades, and became a leading scholar in Shia Islam. He began expounding upon his political philosophy and teaching his growing number of students in Rome. By the early 1960s, he found himself going head-on against the regime of the Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who had embarked on a secularization campaign in Iranian society and had humiliated the Iranian nation by capitulating to American demands that their occupying soldiers not face justice in Iranian courts if they committed crimes. As the Imam once famously remarked, they have reduced the Iranian people to a level lower than that of an American dog. If someone runs over a dog belonging to an American, he will be prosecuted. Even if the Shah himself were to run over a dog belonging to an American, he would be prosecuted. But if an American cook runs over the Shah, or the Marja of Iran, or the highest official, no one will have the right to object. Faced with such fearless opposition from the Imam and his followers, the Shah had him arrested, which led to mass protests that the regimes responded to by killing over 400 Iranians. The Shah then sent him into exile, first to Turkey and then to Iraq, where he stayed for 13 years, living and teaching in the holy city of Najaf. 1978, with the Shah facing mass opposition and his regime fearful of the influence Imam Khomeini had over the revolutionaries, the Shah requested Iraq to expel him, and he was exiled to France by then Vice President of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. But the resistance to the Shah's regime intensified, and he fled Iran in January 1979, never to return. And a few short weeks later, Imam Khomeini landed back in Tehran, where he would soon establish the Islamic Republic of Iran and cement Iran's independence from the global system of international Zionist domination.
Joining us on the show this week to discuss this historic occasion are two very special guests. With me in the studio is Sister Zahra Sabeti, who is a Part II architect and filmmaker. Zahra's interests lie in religious and socio-political affairs, occasionally writing articles and reflection pieces on various online platforms. And joining us via Skype is Sister Sahar Jaber. Sahar has an honours degree in sociology and communication studies from McMaster University. She resides in Lebanon, where she studies at the Islamic Seminary. She co-founded Figs and Olives Publications, an Islamic publishing house aiming to provide reliable and impactful resources for parents, institutions, and children in English. Thank you for joining us both. Sister Sahar, if we could begin by asking you, what was it about the personality of Sayyid al-Imam al-Khomeini that made him so charismatic as to be able to lead the revolution?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you so much for having us on the show and for talking about such an integral conversation. Imam Khomeini, I really do believe that there was absolutely no one that could have taken the role as he did. He took it so honorably. A lot of the characteristics that he held, such as his ability to actually rationalize when it was that we needed a force or when it was that we needed peace, when it was that we should now learn more and educate ourselves, or when should we just stop and observe. These key characteristics, we don't really see them a lot, especially with leaders who may be emotionally intertwined with it, or they just are impulsive in their actions. And so especially with Imam Khomeini, a lot of the characteristics that made him stand out from any other leader was his ability to not only observe, but to know when to act. And patience and sincerity was what allowed the Iranian revolution to actually lead to the success that they had. And so we do understand from this aspect that not only does it take for a leader or someone in that political power, in that political position, to have wealth and resources and the ability to fight, but it also takes for them to have the ability to understand what actions should they take right now. And especially with Imam Khomeini, he made America tremble. He was someone that lived off of dates and garlic and salt. He was a very basic man. He would make the most important people come and sit on the floor with him and have these conversations on the floor, on a rug. And so at no point in time was it ever that America could actually, show Imam something and try to persuade them into turning into something else. Because he was not, like, opposing to the Shah. He was not interested in money or power or those loving him. He was only interested in making God happy. And that's what America, of course, had no ability to actually put in front of the Imam.
Absolutely, and a wonderful answer there. And I think another important aspect is how much things changed in Iran, Sister Zahra, because when the revolution happened, before that, under the Shah, Iran was a staunch ally to the Zionist entity. But that all changed after the revolution. What was it about the thought process of Imam Khomeini, his ideology, that caused such a change that Iran then became a state that supports resistance factions throughout the region?
Yes. So Imam Khomeini's worldview, essentially, was that all aspects of governance and politics must be informed via an Islamic spirit, a spirit of God, you know, a Tawhidi spirit, the oneness of God. And so we see that Iran went from a nation governed by a Western-backed monarchy to a nation that is freed from the clenched fangs of those superpowers. And this took a man with a dream and a will predicated upon the Islamic spirit, in which this spirit was based upon defending the rights of the oppressed, It was based upon ridding foreign imposition as well as seeking the prevalence of justice. And so we see that in today's day and age, the major foreign, major part of Iranian foreign policy is that it champions all oppressed causes, you know, and it's against all nations that are, you know, it's against all oppressive forces. And it's amazing in the sense that currently we don't see that the West takes Iran as a threat in the sense that it cannot plunder within its resources or within its economy or the nation as it did with the Shah in place. Rather, the threat at this current day and age is the fact that Iran represents this free model. Iran is a free model of independence against oppressive forces, and that is influencing the region. It's influencing those within Lebanon, as we saw it adopted this model when it drove out the IOF in 1982. It was adopted by the Yemenis against Western conspiracies by its proxy Saudi. It was adopted by Iraq, the Hashd al-Sha'bi, in the wake of Daesh. And so we see that Iran places Palestine at the forefront. The Palestinian file is the most priority, and you know, it's worked with many Palestinian factions in order to strengthen the existing resistance. And prior to 1979, no movement had the courage to speak out and place Palestine as its central cause. But Imam Khomeini stood and established this along with the nation, and this is why it's subjected to ruthless economic sanctions and trade embargoes.
Absolutely, and that's perhaps made the Islamic Republic more self-reliant in many ways as well. Now, of course, Sister Saha, just to come back to you, the revolution did, of course, make Iran an Islamic Republic with the state guided by Islamic Sharia. Why was this such an important thing to the Imam?
This was an integral thing for the Imam, because under the Imam's understanding, if we were to actually live, as Sister Zahra has beautifully said, the Islamic spirit, the Imam really believed that it's not actually possible to live this Islamic spirit, to actually be in a place of God in all things, in all aspects, such as khumus, or such as with the laws of when someone is to be trialed. In all aspects of an individual, it's not possible for us to live in that Islamic spirit unless we are governed under one too. And so the Imam really did believe that it's not to say that we should at a forefront force this opinion on everyone, but for that to actually be something that is working on as us, as a Muslim country, as a Muslim nation, we need to work towards this. We are the majority, and so it is important, it is integral towards us. And so this spirit, infused with the spirit of tawheed and of obedience, the Imam believed that la ajidu ibada afdal min khidmat al-nas. And so I do not find a way better to worship God than by serving his people. And so always, at all times, he believed that an Islamic government was necessary. And when we talk about the Imam, we have to understand and contextualize that this man was an intelligent individual. He had a reputation for being an academic, for being a philosopher. He would teach, and everyone would work towards actually trying to find his lecture, trying to be in his presence because of the knowledge that he had. So put apart everything that he's actually done for the Islamic institution or for the Islamic government, he in himself was an academic, was an intelligent individual. And so if he is going to say that an Islamic government is necessary, he knew what he was talking about with the credibility and the reliability that he had from the Hawz institution.
Absolutely. And of course, Iran's foreign policy has been heavily centered on support for Palestine. We take a look now at what practical steps the Islamic Republic has taken to support the Palestinian struggle for liberation from Zionist subjugation.
Following the revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and started supporting the Palestinians, symbolized by turning over the Israeli embassy in Tehran to the Palestine Liberation Organization, which has since become the Embassy of Palestine. Since 1979, Iran has been the biggest ally of the Palestinian liberation movement. From providing intelligence, financial and logistical support directly to the resistance, to running the blockade and siege of Gaza by sending ships carrying tons of advanced weaponry, some of which have been hijacked by the occupation forces. Iran increasingly trained resistance fighters in Gaza and helped develop local weapons production, and they are now in possession of missile capabilities and technologies. For more than five decades, Iran's goal has been to be the vanguard of the Islamic world, including in alliances with Sunni movements to transcend the sectarian divide. As the foundation of the Axis of Resistance, it has championed groups outside of Palestine, solidifying the strength of these powers in removing the imperial control over Arab and Islamic regions. Most notably, Iran has stopped the spread of Takfiri groups like ISIS, like Daesh, funded by Western imperialist powers, through these ties in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen. From the beginning of Iran's revolution, Imam Khomeini stated that one of his goals was the liberation of Palestine from the occupying regime. In launching Al-Quds Day, he called on Muslims to dedicate this day to demanding the rights of oppressed Muslims around the world, particularly in Palestine. The Islamic Republic has also led the way for other countries in its unrelenting campaign, encouraging the public and everyday Muslims to combat misinformation by pushing us to understand the duties of Jihad al-Tabyeen. Jihad al-Tabyeen is the term that loosely translates into struggle for clarification, which is one of the forms of jihad that Islam advocates. It is the jihad of preaching and teaching to rebut false and misleading arguments, fabrications, lies, and distortion. It is no longer just a duty for world leaders, but for us at the societal level. Today, the people of the world are taking up this call from all walks of life, advocating for the Palestinian liberation movement in all their spaces. And instead of throwing stones, the Palestinians are now able to fight for the liberation of their own lands by virtue of the arms they possess.
Now, Sister Zahra, we were just hearing there some of the practical steps that Iran has taken. Maybe you could expand more on what kind of measures these have been, diplomatically, financially, and militarily.
Sure, yes. So, as we've just heard, Iran has been supporting and has given full support morally, within the field, within security, within financial, to the resistance factions who are all fighting a common enemy. And despite all of this, I think the most important support that Iran has given is actually revolutionary support. Iran has determined the course for the Palestinian cause, essentially. What Iran has done is that through this revolutionary support, it has highlighted to the entire world that this biggest shame that has ever occurred in the face of humanity, where world superpowers colluded to uproot the Palestinian nation and replace it with another nation, this can be corrected and this can be reversed. And this awoke the hearts of the people. It enabled them to take the responsibility within their own hands and to say, we have the power to create this change. And because of this, we find that this revolutionary support and, you know, its encouraged people, it did more than military and financial support. It did more than the military and financial support simply because, you know, yes, America has funds its allies and its puppets with tons of money and weaponry and whatnot. However, this revolutionary support is a key component because it gives the spirit of jihad, whereas America and the superpowers, they are missing this key component. The spirit of jihad is not there. This is why you find that in Gaza, they are not able, the IOF is not able to fight in one-on-one combat. Instead, it resorts to, you know, cowardly dropping bombs from the sky because that spirit is missing. And we have a quote by Sayyida Fatima alayhi salam, the daughter of the Holy Prophet, who says that, "Wal jihadu 'izzatun lil Islam." Jihad, the struggle of jihad, the spirit of jihad is the honor of Islam and the humiliation for the people of polytheism and hypocrisy, because it's the spirit of jihad that protects an ummah, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they've managed to change the whole, I guess, mindset of those in Palestine, or at least encourage those who are already on that revolutionary path. Sister Sahar, if we could just return to you as a Hausa student, of course. What could you tell us about the way in which the Hausa landscape itself changed post-1979, whereby Islam and politics are more commonly seen as two inseparable entities?
The understanding of politics and Hausa and them being two separate entities, of course, Imam Khomeini was one of the first to actually introduce it in this grand scale. And a lot of them had differing opinions from the Hausa itself. Not to say that they didn't want this, but to say that they questioned whether or not this was actually possible at this time, whether or not it was an okay thing to make to encourage or to allow for 1,000 people to give their lives up for this. It was a very big deal in the Hausa to study it from an Islamic perspective, whether or not this would be permissible or whether or not we should put politics in Hausa and allow it to be intertwined. Now, from Imam Khomeini's aspect, as we've spoken from before, because he believed that we should be living and being governed in an Islamic state, he worked towards that. And because he had, this is very integral, because he had such a strong standing in the Hausa, he studied under the most prominent shuha, of course, like Sheikh Yazdi. He studied with the most intelligent individuals for a very long time from such a young age. He was respected and he had a very good reputation. Because of this, when he did decide that politics and Hausa should be intertwined, many were then willing to actually agree to him. So we have to put into context his background. But we do know that dinana ayn siyasatina wa siyasatina ayn dinana. And so this relationship is necessary, that our politics, just as we see in our Islam, you know, most of Islam is based on laws. And so to be able to enforce that, that's the dream of the Anbiya. That's the dream of the prophets, as Mullah Sadr says.
Absolutely. And just to come back as well to yourself, Sister Zahra, we know that Iran has taken these stances since the revolution. As Sister Saha was just saying there, Imam Khomeini revolutionized not just the state, but of course the nature of Islamic teachings in the Hausa as well. But that's all come with a price. What kind of price has Iran paid since those days of 1979 for their stance against mainly, you know, international Zionism?
Of course, any entity or any country or nation that is going to stand in front of imperialist policymakers will face a whole barrage of challenges. And Iran has been no exemption to that. Essentially, Iran has been suffering the worst conspiracy plans on the nation. It has gone through an eight-year war. It has been subjected to defamation, demonization, you know, being called terrorists, supporters of terrorism, labeled as the bad guy, you know, soft war and smear campaigns, which essentially is an attempt to create internal fracture within the country and in order to garner international consent as a collective punishment for the country. But despite all of this, these sanctions and ruthless trade embargoes have actually benefited Iran, because had it not been for them, Iran would not be the self-sufficient, standing, independent entity that it is today. Essentially, Iran's economy, despite all of the sanctions, it is a real economy. Why? Because the conditions it is going through is unbelievable. The conditions it has been placed under has caused it to thrive still as it is today. And if any other country was to face these maximum pressure policy by the American administration, it would essentially collapse. And so despite all of this, you know, this revolution has awoken the hearts of the people in the sense that they've realized that Iran is, you know, it has been blessed with ample space, with ample resources, and that people should be excelling in aspects and sectors such as the intellectual, technological, economic, medical, whatever field, because it is now, you know, under sanctions and it cannot have as much import, so it needs to manufacture its own products. And therefore, despite these sanctions, you know, Iran has stood on its feet, it has been independent, and never once has it given up or abandoned the Palestinian cause.
And interestingly as well, and you may want to even expand on this a little bit, its own arms. Because, you know, all the weapons, or most of the weapons that we see them providing to the resistance factions in the region are domestically produced.
Exactly. It's been domestically produced because they have been infused with the spirit that we must excel, that we are an Islamic governance and we need to reflect Islam, essentially. We need to reflect the teachings of God and the teachings that you cannot be oppressed. You cannot, no matter what you go through, this is the teachings of the prophets and the imams, that you must remain strong and excel in whatever you do, and therefore it has been producing and manufacturing despite the embargoes.
And if I may just ask you one last question from a personal perspective. The revolution, you're a young person, you were born after the revolution, and yet you hold to its values and you have seen the value that it has brought to the world, to Iran and elsewhere. I mean, what does that mean to you as a young person? Because some people say, oh, it's old, it's had its time, and, you know, we need a new system. But there are many who don't agree with that.
So essentially, I would say that the Islamic Revolution is a stepping stone towards the actualization of the Imam, Ajallah Ta'ala Farajuhu Sharif, to his reappearance. And so in order to hold on to this line, you are actually holding on to the line of the Imam. And this means actively waiting, not just to wait. This is essentially what the Islamic Revolution represents, that in the occultation of the Imam, it's best that you have someone who is righteous to lead over an Ummah, as opposed to, you know, opening up the field to the likes of Saddam and Trump. And therefore, this is a spirit we hold as young individuals, that wherever we may be, in our workplaces, at homes, within our societies, we must excel and do the best to benefit society with God's remembrance.
Thank you so much, Sister Zahra, for your wonderful words. And also to yourself there in Lebanon, Sister Sahar as well. That's all that we have time for today. I want to thank again our guests, but also you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.